do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go, F1 Podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. My name's Diane Bortoletto, and I'm your pre-Drive to Survive Formula One fan, and today I'm in Perth. And I've got a very exciting guest for you today, Chris Holding. He is the owner of Palm 7 Films, a production company that produces content for brands and broadcast. He's worked with every major UK broadcaster, including BBC, ITV and Channel 4, as well as ESPN, IMG, News Corp, Discovery, and in Australia, Channel 7, 9 and 10, and there's a whole bunch more. He's worked on every major sporting code you can think of, 3 years full-time on Formula One, plus more, the World Rally Championship, Grand Slam Tennis, the English Premier League, the Olympics, the Paralympics, and more. What an incredible career, and it's still going. So huge welcome to the show, Chris. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We first met, it must have been 2002, which was my first year working on the World Rally Championship in Perth. Obviously, your career was in full flight then. Just tell us a little bit about how you got started in broadcasting and broadcasting in sport.
Sure. Well, thanks. Nice to be here. I started really, I think, my interest in motorsport began as a kid. I actually lived in the UK and I lived not far from Brands Hatch Circuit, probably about 15 miles away. And on summer days when races were going, if the wind blew in the right direction, you could hear the engines of the cars. And I was probably 6 or 7 at the time. And, you know, every young kid is massively into, you know, I was really into cars, toy cars, and it just sort of fired my imagination. And living, I didn't actually end up going to the circuit till I was older, but I would watch Formula One on the television. It used to be, it was predominantly European at that stage, with a few internationals, people driving like James Hunt, Niki Lauda. I'm that old, and although I was very, very young, and then eventually that moved through into people like Nigel Mansell and Damon Hill. And that's sort of the period when I started to work. I got a job with Star TV in 1995. And one of the first things we did into, Damon Hill won the world championship in 1996. And he came over and did an interview while we were at Star TV. So I met a world champion in 1995. It was my first pro gig working on the Macau Grand Prix, which Ralph Schumacher won. So working on that event, I was a researcher or production assistant. It's a street circuit. I was running around the pit lane, getting information, supplying stuff to the commentators and the producers and the exec producer, and spending a lot of time in the press room, the media room, and getting results. And it was just so, it was like being on a movie set. It was everything you think motorsport is. I got totally hooked up in it. And from that point on, I really knew that it was my goal was to try and get into Formula One.
Wow. So how long did it take you to get into Formula One?
It took a while. I mean, it was into all motorsport, but when I worked at the BBC, I was doing things like British Touring Cars. I did World Superbikes, MotoGP, lots of things around the Emirates. And, you know, I was interested in all of those things. I also started working on the World Rally Championship, but it was a post-produced show, not live. So I would go out to events and record and then come back and make a show after the event. And I was having dealings with some Formula One people, and I enjoyed rally. It was great. In fact, there's a real synergy between the World Rally Championship and Formula One. You've got people like Nick Fryer, who went on to BAR Honda. You've got Dave Richards, who was also BAR Honda. You've got Jean Todt, who was the former president of the FIA, used to be a rally co-driver. Lots of crossover.
Gunter? Was it Gunter Steiner as well? Was it?
Yeah, Gunter Steiner, exactly. Yeah, exactly. He was, I think, with Ford Rally Team. I used to deal with Gunter a lot then. Yeah, so there's always been a lot of crossover. In fact, Robert Reed was working for the FIA as Richard Burns' co-driver until fairly recently. So, yeah, I was having dealings around that. And then 2005, the contract with ITV ended. It had been on Channel 4, then on ITV. And a slot became available to work at 2006. So my first season doing Formula One full-time was 2006 with ITV. And it was a great great time to start because it was the great years, the year Alonso got his, I think, second title. But on top of that, Lewis Hamilton was just starting, and one of my responsibilities, even though I was doing Formula One, was also making a post-produced show about GP2, which was the feeder series for F1. So that was Lewis Hamilton's debut year in GP2, and I charted that and spent lots of time with a very young Lewis Hamilton. So that was the first year, 2006.
Wow. And then you did 3 years full-time on Formula One. But before we talk about that, let's just tell us a little bit about a young Lewis Hamilton. When he entered Formula One, like, I thought, oh my God, this is the poster kid for F1, for the future of F1, you know, a rags to, not riches, well, riches now, but at the time, like a rags to riches story. Like, he came from nothing, just didn't fit the usual mold of what a Formula One driver was. And he was just so humble and so grateful. And to some respects, I think he still is a lot more experienced, obviously, with 7 titles to his name. But yeah, tell us about your experience working alongside a young Lewis and his family.
Yeah, he was great from the outset. I mean, he's very family focused. He would often have his half brother with him, his stepmother, and then his dad. Anthony Hamilton was very hands on at that point. I think he still managed him up until around about 2010. So I spent quite a bit of time with Anthony. Lewis's time was fairly scarce on the ground, but he always made a lot of time for us. He was competing with Art GP, and in fact, the sort of two team bosses of that were Nicolas Todd, Jean Todt's son, who was also Felipe Massa's manager at that point. And the team boss of Art GP was actually Frédéric Vasseur, so the current boss of Ferrari. So those guys go back a very, very long way. Lewis got the crown that year, so he won. And I think Nico Rosberg had won the year before. We spent a lot of time with him. We did stuff. I remember filming stuff around. He had a Winnebago for Silverstone Grand Prix. He was staying on the circuit in a Winnebago. He was very good with his time. Very family oriented, quite quiet, a little bit shy, but very steely, very determined, and super talented. It was very clear that he was, you know, going to go all the way. Had some great performances in GP2. I mean, one standout was the Turkey race where he actually spun, went to 18th, and then fought back through to get to second place. I think you can see it online. It's a really good race. And that tells you a lot about his driving style and his commitment and determination. So he was great to work with. And I think he's, despite all the millions and millions of dollars, I imagine he's still very much the same.
You know, I actually just saw a clip on social media this morning that said that Lewis Hamilton has funded a dog rescue organisation throughout Europe to help care for abandoned and ageing dogs to make sure that their end of their days are spent with, you know, care and love. And I just thought that's brilliant.
Yeah, because he's just lost his own dog, I think, hasn't he?
Yeah, Roscoe, yeah, just in the last few weeks. Really sad. Being a dog owner myself, my little dog is just down there sleeping at my feet. I can't even think of the day when she's not around. I can't think about it because they really do become part of your family. But what are your thoughts on Lewis at Ferrari?
He usually makes quite good moves. Obviously, he got his title with McLaren, Mercedes, and then moved eventually to Mercedes. That was quite a controversial move at the time because they were an unproven team. Obviously, a team with a lot of experience in motorsport, but, you know, they didn't have any results. And other teams that had tried to do that, like Honda and, in fact, BMW, who'd made big forays and spent a lot of money, hadn't done anything. So it was quite risky moving from a team that he'd won the championship with to move to Mercedes, and he made it work. So the move to Ferrari, I mean, as we've seen this year with the Mercedes team, they're fast, they're competitive, and they've improved. But even with George, who knows the car very well, they haven't really got the results. You do wonder whether he would have been sort of biding his time. With the regulation change for next season, it's going to be really open to who actually is dominant. But I think the move to Ferrari is good. I think it's a sort of quite a romantic one for a driver. You know, if you've driven and you've got world titles, to not have spent time at Ferrari would be considered a shame. Obviously, Alonso's done it, Raikkonen did it, and Vettel as well. So I think an opportunity that's too good to pass up. But the team does work in a very, very specific way. And I do think has struggled this year. But he's a great driver. I'm not quite sure what the reasons behind that would be, but I do know that he'll be giving it his all, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with the new regulations. I mean, one thing I really like is changes. I think those two dominant period, the dominant period for Mercedes and the dominant period for Red Bull with Verstappen, I think it's not so good for the sport. I think it's best when there's good competition and you've got different manufacturers and marks being able to take wins. I think a return to that would be good. And clearly Ferrari, McLaren and Red Bull are very, very close at the moment. So those new regulations will be interesting. We'll see which driver style it suits and who adapts the quickest. But yeah, I think it was a good move to Ferrari overall. Yeah.
Yeah, I really would love to see Lewis get his 8th world title with Ferrari. I think that would just be a storybook ending to almost what could have been a really unlikely career, given his background, you know, his dad working 3 jobs and his background of nothing and just rising up through the ranks. I think that'd be a really last chapter for his career to get that 8th with Ferrari. So yeah, let's hope that next year or the year after, if he stays, delivers.
Yeah. No, I think it would be good for him.
You worked on Formula One for 3 full seasons and then some other times post that. What was that like traveling to every single event on the calendar?
It's the best job in the world. It's absolutely, of all the work that I've done, and I've worked on lots of different sports, and they've all been great, and they've all had different things about them that were good. But far and away, the best job in the world is working in Formula One. It's very demanding of your time because now there's even more races than ever. But I mean, I loved it. Yeah, it was absolutely fantastic. Going to all the circuits, are different and unique. You have your favourites, but even ones that aren't your favourite, there's always something about it. It's the rivalry, the money, but then the raw sportsmanship, the destinations, the difference, the languages, the different hotels, everything about it is, if you think it's glamorous, it is.
Brilliant. I can imagine it'd be a dream for so many people, myself included, to have done that. And when it comes to working with the drivers, like, I expect part of your job there was to interview the drivers pre and post race and quali and whatnot. Were there any surprising drivers or any drivers where you thought, oh, looking forward to interviewing this one, and then they were just not good on camera, or the other way around, not sure about one driver who just gave you absolute gold?
Yeah, they all vary depending on where they're at in their race weekend, maybe their career and their headspace at that moment in time. I would generally work with a reporter, so the reporter would ask the questions, but I would be there producing. Look, most of them were good. Mark Webber was always an interesting guy because very good driver, really nice to chat to, quite shy in some ways. But he sort of didn't really have a media personality. He's not very media sort of savvy. So he was always quite interesting, very intelligent, and would always give a good appraisal of things. But he hasn't gone down the path of going to media. Jenson Button was always a bit, wouldn't always necessarily be forthcoming. But now he's moved into a media role himself. It's interesting to see the change. He's a lot more effusive and gives longer answers. I think he, at the time as a driver, he saw it as a bit of a pain to have to do some of it. That's really changed with a lot of the drivers now. A lot of them are a lot more accepting of it and they treat it more as a conversation. And I think that's to the advantage. There were other drivers that were always, you know, good for a chat. Lewis was always very good with his time with interviews. And then you'd have, I mean, Fernando Alonso can be quite mercurial, to put it politely. He can have his ups and his downs, still driving today. But yeah, there's no one that was, they're all pretty media savvy. They've all come up through junior ranks. They've all had to do media for a long period of time. But there were definitely those that enjoyed it or saw it as part of the job, and others that found it quite tiresome. Probably the peak of that is Kimi Raikkonen.
I was about to say, did you interview Kimi?
Yeah, all the media loved Kimi Raikkonen. And I think one of the reasons that we all liked him is that he didn't play the game and he could give you a one-word answer. Amazing driver, you know, very talented, sort of quite an old school driver in that sense, like a bit naughty, doing some things off track. And I think that's why people liked him. He's a bit of a rock star on the quiet. And because he made himself so bland and boring in terms of his media, everyone thought that he was quite a dull person. Also, that's a particular trait of Finnish drivers. He was not like that at all. He was a bit of a rock star, actually. So you never know. The media persona doesn't necessarily tell you about the driver.
I absolutely love that clip of him you know, in the race car with him telling his race engineer, leave me alone, I know what I'm doing. And then there's another clip of him that I absolutely love, where I think he was at a press conference and a journalist or the MC asked why he was late. He said, I was taking a dump, but I don't think he used the word dump. I think another word. I just thought, oh my goodness. Yeah, Iceman. Yeah, I really miss having Kimi on the grid. I just really loved his style.
He was a real character. I mean, it's before my time that there was the classic clip of him. He was in Monaco. I think the car retired, had an engine failure or something, and he just parked the car up, walked around the outside of the circuit, went to the boat where he was staying with friends and just started partying before the race had even ended. And there was a shot of him on the boat. He didn't debrief with the team, didn't talk to his engineer, or I think the team boss at the time was Ron Dennis, so, which wouldn't have gone down very well with him. Yeah, he was a bit of a legend, yeah.
So good. And speaking of legends and legendary, the epic montage that you produce, I think, was that for the end of the ITV broadcast? And, you know, features My Chemical Romance song. I was just listening to it and watching it again before we jumped on this podcast, and it just got me all fired up. It must have taken ages to put that together.
It did. It did. Yeah. So, yeah, 2008 was the year that Lewis won his first championship. And ITV had also lost the contract, or they actually gave it up through financial reasons. So it was sort of an end of an era. The Formula One had been on ITV in the UK since, I think, was like 1997, so it was a fair while. It was a bit of a seminal moment, and I was tasked with doing something that encapsulated that. So it had to include really every world champion from the period of time that ITV had been covering it, seeing the rise and fall of a number of different drivers. Also, I mean, it's probably fair to say at this point that Drive to Survive has really kind of probably extended or widened the appeal of Formula One, and that's something that all of us that were working in it were trying to do even back then in the Bernie era. But Bernie had this idea of everything had to be paid for and nothing happened unless there was a dollar attached to it. And so really, as our parting shot, I was trying to create something that was a bit fun, that showed the more humorous and frivolous side of the drivers. And not all of them were up for it straight away. Once we got a few in the bag, Sebastian Vettel was one of the first that we recorded actually for that clip. And he was great. He said yes straight away. We did two clips with him. He totally got it. Other people were a bit more nervous. I remember Jensen being a bit nervous. Rubens Barrichello was very up for it and kind of got Jensen into doing it. Nico Rosberg was very, very keen on it. He got it straight away. So once we got a few in the bag, we would then show them to other drivers, and then their natural competitiveness came in about, you know, well, he's in it, so I'll need to be in it. Again, the only one who didn't follow that was Kimi Räikkönen.
Oh, gosh.
We got most in there. We got Mario Tyson, who was the boss of BMW, was in it. But it wasn't just about Formula One drivers. It was about everyone who works here. We had catering staff. We had race engineers. We had TV presenters. There were all sorts. There were also seminal moments during that period of Grand Prix racing. So it had to encapsulate all of those things. So it was a real mix, very eclectic, and it had to be driven by this song, which is excellent. It sort of took on a life of its own. It took about probably all up 3 to 4 months to film it across various different Grand Prix locations. It was good to do. I really enjoyed doing it, and it was sort of a fitting tribute for our time.
I saw a part of that clip, because the whole montage goes for about just a bit under 4 minutes, and I saw just a part of that clip with the drivers lip syncing to that, you know, awesome rock song on Instagram, and I was like, oh, this is so cool. Like, how have I not seen this before? And then here you are, the guy behind it. Yeah, it's brilliant. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and make sure you click on that if you love Formula One. And if you've been a Formula One fan for some time, you're going to love it if you haven't seen it already.
Yeah, Coulthard and DC and Weber are both in it as well. They were great. They were very hands-on with it. It's taken on a bit of a life of its own. I had some people contact me about it and say, you do know this is still kind of like trending around the internet every once in a while, which is nice to know.
Like I said, I didn't actually realise that was you who had produced it when I saw the clip. Oh, it's brilliant. So make sure you check that out, guys. But speaking of music and Formula One, you also worked in Singapore on F1 Rocks. Who was involved in that? And tell us what F1 Rocks is.
That was another very insane project. It was great because I've been working in Formula One. I'm still doing some stuff for the BBC who had taken over the Formula One contract. So I was doing odd rounds for them. And then my old company, North One Television, had got this project where Universal Music were fusing with Formula One. It was a deal where Bernie was trying to make more money. And they were trying to bring rock and pop acts into Formula One weekends for making money. And so they wanted to try a program where they would have a synergy of two of the most time poor people in the world, international rock stars and Formula One drivers. So that was the blue sky thinking behind it, was let's take these two incredibly time poor people and put them together in a show where they have some sort of cross connection. So the show had Beyonce, Gwen Stefani, No Doubt were in it. We had ZZ Top, Simple Minds, rather bizarrely, all sorts of people that were playing in the Singapore Grand Prix 2009. And we had Mark Webber doing stuff with some actually Australian stuntmen. He did a fake sort of fight with a ninja in the show. We also had a radio-controlled car battle between No Doubt and I think it was Adrian Sutil at the time. It was with Force India at that time. It was a crazy show. Some of it was filmed before. Some of it was filmed while we were in Singapore. A real mixture. And again, it was part of this sort of trying to move towards a drive to survive, that there's that the drivers are interesting people and do things outside of it. And we had the Black Eyed Peas doing a pit stop challenge. We had Fergie and Will I Am in the pit lane doing that. It was a really fun show to work on. It took about 3 months in total, if I remember correctly, and trying to, again, persuade different manufacturers to get involved and to not be shy, to not be embarrassed, and to take a bit of a risk and do something fresh and new. So it was fantastic. It was a good gig.
And like Singapore still puts on like mega music shows and concerts as part of their Grand Prix weekend. Yeah, they had Elton John this year. Yeah, doesn't get much bigger than that. Yeah. Well, you also work with Ted Kravitz, who's of course part of the current F1 broadcast that we get here in Australia on Sky Sports. And you've also told me about a tribute that he's given you in his book.
Ted actually contacted me recently because he's got a book out, which I'm F1 Insider, Notes from the Pit Lane. And he referenced the video that we've already spoken about, which was quite fun. So I was having a chat with him. He's been in F1. He started before me. He was, I think, in ITV from 1997. He did all that whole period before I joined. And then when the contract changed from ITV to the BBC, he stayed with it. And now he's carried on through to Sky. So, I mean, without embarrassing him, he's probably been there for, well, a while. Yes. So he obviously felt it was time to do a book. I haven't read it apart from the mention that he sent me in there, but I'm sure there's some fascinating insights. He's been there for all this time, through all those different broadcasters and through all those different Grand Prix. So, yes, probably worth checking out. He'll enjoy that I'm giving his book a plug, I'm sure.
He'd have stories galore, particularly of the, I don't want to say olden days, but, you know, 20 years ago, I guess, probably when there were less restrictions around or less social media presence, when the drivers could get away with more than what they can now. Going back to, you know, James Hunt, like that era where, you know, F1 drivers, not all of them, but a lot of them were party boys and partying. And now they're all kind of sensible and in lovely long-term relationships. That's all great to see, but I wonder whether the change of era, I wonder how much influence social media has had on that, in that you can't really get away with a whole lot now because everyone's got a camera in their pocket, right? So
absolutely,
things have changed.
No, he would have seen a lot. And I should reference that Ted was actually one of the presenters of GP2 in Lewis's season-winning year, so it was Ted and Louise Goodman would rock and roll between being the presenters. So he spent a lot of time with Lewis back then in 2006 as well. But yes, social media has definitely changed. I guess, as you say, everyone's got a camera in their pocket, and there's situations where drivers have got a speeding fine, or there was an incident recently where Lando Norris had lent one of his cars to a friend and they pranged it. And little things like that would never have seen the light of day now appear. So yeah, I think they're a lot more careful. I guess with more money and more power comes more responsibility. So yes, but it's a lot of weight to put on guys who are effectively 21, 22, 23. I'm not sure that I would have been that sensible at that age, but yeah.
Same. Yeah, it is a lot. I often hear about the commentators and then they talk about people like George Russell now being a leader in the Mercedes team. Like he's still, 26 or something? Like it's so young, even though they are experienced, to be part of the senior management team of an organization that's got 1,600 people, 2,000 people, whatever that may be. It's mega. That's huge.
Absolutely, yeah. No, it is. Yeah. And so many sponsors, and a lot of reputations on the line, all encapsulated. I mean, it is very much a team sport, team effort. But at the end of the day, if the guy in the cockpit doesn't produce the goods, then they don't last, and neither does the team, neither does the manager. It's very cutthroat. I think it's one of the things that if you're not involved, it is interesting. But, I mean, these are all people's jobs and livelihoods on the line, whether they're race engineers, drivers or whatever. I sometimes think it's interesting if you think about the numbers of drivers that were good and were there around F1 that are no longer there. The Pastor Maldonados, the Timo Glocks, you know, lots and lots of drivers that were there for a while, Nick Heidfeld, people like that who were good drivers, but it really is the pinnacle of motorsport, and to stay there and to stay there for a long time, you do need to be really good. So yeah, it speaks to people like Alonso, Raikkonen, Hamilton, Verstappen. They all have something. All of the drivers in Formula One are very good, but only some of them, you know, really rise to the level that those guys do.
And speaking of drivers, do you have is there a driver that you follow closely that you, you know, Barrett for or a team?
Yes and no. I mean, I've always kept fairly neutral. It's not like soccer where, you know, you have one team, and there's always a nostalgia and a passion for Ferrari. They're a great team. I spent a lot of time with McLaren Mercedes, less time with Mercedes, a fair bit of time with Red Bull. Red Bull, again, were a great team when they came in. They were all about fun. They were all about kind of that drive to survive thing. And they were ridiculed by a lot of the people in the paddock back then. They used to have a magazine called Red Bull Magazine, which they would produce every day, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, during a race weekend.
Right.
And they would be distributed around the paddock. And there would be sort of gossip and stories and in-jokes and stuff about food, stuff, you know, funny things that had happened between. But it was produced very, very professionally. And a lot of the people in the paddock at that time, in terms of the team bosses, weren't very keen on it. But it started that movement towards a slightly freer, slightly more, you know, embracing the entertainment factor of what's going on. All the teams are good, really. I wouldn't say there was one that ever had a problem with. I suppose the British teams, there's a lot of them. There was a natural affinity towards being able to understand and talk with them. But Ferrari were always very hospitable and welcome. And I do like all of the marks, really, the main ones. And even the new Aston Martin coming back is great. I'm not sure how Cadillac will go when they step in. But I think having lots of different manufacturers is a good thing. And competition is the best thing. And so having lots of different manufacturers helps. So I don't really stay exclusive to one. I'm very pleased that McLaren are having success this year. They haven't really had any success since, well, in constructors and stuff like that, since 2008. So it's good to see them challenge Mercedes and Red Bull and to see those differences come out. So yeah, there's no one particular team that I support.
Like you said earlier, it is so good for the sport to have the championship so close and not to have one team or one driver totally dominate. I was kind of hoping that was going to be Oscar Piastri this season. I've said from the start of the season that this is his year, and I still think he's in for a chance. Like, oh, it's going to be tight, though. It's going to be tough. But being British,
I think Oscar's amazing. Look, I think a lot of Australians got behind Mark. Mark was a great driver. I think he had his chances. There were a couple of moments where he might have got a title. Very, very tough competition the time he was driving in. And maybe the car wasn't quite the powerhouse that it later became. And Daniel, you know, good driver, I think, was probably good early on and then petered off a little bit. And sort of that classic Aussie larrikin, I think people warmed to him. Whereas Oscar is not so obviously Australian. He's more, I love the fact that he's kind of been mentored by Alain Prost. He's much more of an Alain Prost-style driver. He's right. Very calculated, very quiet, very focused, very determined. And I think domestically in Australia, he has struggled a little bit because he doesn't come across as maybe Australian drivers have done in the past. But he's the real deal. Whether it's this year, next year, or the year after, I think he's a world champion. I don't say that lightly. I wouldn't be saying that about just any driver. I think he really has the skill set. You do have to get that alchemy right of having the car, the opportunities, and all of it working together. And certainly this season has been really interesting because there's been periods of growth, periods of victories, and then periods of self-doubt for both him and Lando. So I think it's... Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about the papaya rules. I'm a bit tired of those. But
God, I can't talk about them anymore. I feel like I've talked about them for death.
That's right. The last couple of races, I think they've brought it to a nice period where instead of pointing the finger at each other, they both realise that the race is on and let's try and make it fair. They've got Max, you know, all the while they're worried about each other. Well, there's Max Verstappen just behind you. I really don't want to see him win, even though I think he's a terrific driver. It's time for someone else to take it. I hope he does push them and I hope he pushes them all the way, but I hope ultimately that he's unsuccessful because it would be nice to see a new, different world champion, whether it's Lando or Oscar. But if Oscar doesn't get it this year...
Pick one. Well, Lando or Oscar.
I really can't. I think they both deserve it, but you won't know until the final race or whenever it's actually decided about. If you think of those championships where it's come down to 1 point, Kimi Raikkonen's came down to 1 point, even the one where Hamilton won, the first one against Massa was very, very tight at Interlagos. Most of those championships that are tight, if things had gone slightly different, if it hadn't rained, if they'd chosen a different tyre, if they hadn't had some sort of incident, you know, and then you can backtrack that back through the season, you know, if they'd got a point for a sprint race that they didn't get. These things all come into play later in the season. So I think, you know, the great thing about this season has been a real change from, I did tune out a little bit during the Mercedes dominance and the Red Bull dominance. And I think this season is really showing everyone what Formula One can be. Lots of different teams, everyone vying. And then even favourites maybe looking like they could falter if things don't go quite the right way. I think that both of them would be worthy winners. They've both done enough, but we won't really know till we get there because there's still pages in the story to be told.
Yeah, there are. Well, I think the whole world around this podcast that listens knows that I'm Team Oscar Piastri. But I will admit that when he was first announced as the McLaren driver, it took me a little while to warm to Oscar because obviously that was at the expense of Daniel Ricciardo, who I was a massive fan of. The very different personalities between Oscar and Daniel, like you said, you know, it just, it took a while to warm to him. But now I just think he's just a great driver. I love his sense of humour, very dry. Chris? Oh, I did want to ask you about Drive to Survive. Like come up a couple of times. And when I worked in London on the Orange Arrows account in a PR agency, part of our brief was to get the team off the sports pages and into the lifestyle pages. You know, like you said, like widen the audience, which Drive to Survive has done very successfully. What are your thoughts on that? On Drive to Survive, do you wish that you had worked on it?
So, yes and no. I mean, that's what we were all, as I mentioned before, we were trying to achieve. We were all moving in that direction and within the constraints of the Bernie Eccleston era. And so I think it was important to see that some of the drivers do hang out, that they do have a natural, you know, friendship or relationship. And that is in itself interesting. And some of the things that they get up to, some of the training that they do, all of that stuff is interesting. Drive to Survive, I do like it. I guess it depends on the season. But I think journalistically it can be a bit wobbly sometimes, which is just a professional thing. And also, whenever you're post-producing something, which that whole series is, it is, in some senses, easier to predict the narrative. It's harder to do it live than it is to give something a narrative. It's quite easy to do that after the event because you can film around it subsequently to make it make sense. So it is something that needed to happen, and I think overall they did a good job, but I think journalistically they take a few liberties with the timeline of how things are going and they sort of up the ante on some things. But overall a really positive force, engaged with more people, with younger people, with women, with a wider demographic, And it's allowed personalities of the drivers to shine, you know. It also doesn't hurt that you've got a new crop of drivers that are a lot more happy to do that sort of stuff. Like we said earlier, I do not see Kimi Raikkonen on Drive to Survive. Like it would have been one of the shortest film clips ever. Overall, I think it's good. But I do think what Formula One as an organization have done moving forward, perhaps they're trying to take some of that essence and do it live, make the races more interesting. I hope they don't go too far. There's a lot of rule changes and a lot of regulation changes coming up, so it remains to be seen. Hopefully we don't lose the essence of a lot of new circuits or in new areas at the expense of perhaps some of the older circuits. I guess we'll see what next year brings.
Well, I think it's probably time to move into the final three, Chris. Are you ready?
Okay. Wow. Yes.
So these are the three questions that we ask every guest on the podcast. So the first question is, if you could choose to have a holiday at any Formula One race destination, whether it's on the calendar or not at the moment, where would you go for a holiday and why?
That is a very, very difficult question. They all have different aspects which make them put them great, whether it's the food or the people. Or for me, it's a very tough call. As I referenced, Spa-Francorchamps is my favourite circuit probably overall. Very boring place to go to, but great racing. So you wouldn't really want a holiday there. So it takes me away from that one. Monaco is not a great circuit for the modern F1 car at the moment, but it is an amazing place. You have to go. I think my passion for Monaco first started with rallying, because rally starts there as well. So I went there many, many times with rallying and the place is just nuts about motorsport. And it's an unusual place during a Grand Prix weekend. It's full of some of the most, it's just a crazy, there's no other Grand Prix like it. So I suppose if I was going to come down to it, you have to experience a race weekend in Monaco. You don't necessarily have to stay in Monaco. It's quite nice to stay outside and come in. But if you are lucky enough to stay in Monaco, it's just crazy. The people walking around, the promotions, I can't describe it really. Obscene wealth. The helicopters, the boats,
the super yachts.
It has to be experienced. It's something quite unique. And it's something that's been in lots of motorsport films. So if you go back to things like the movie Grand Prix itself, when I first got to go there during Grand Prix weekend, it's very special. So probably that one. But I will just make a quick mention of Monza, because I love Monza. It's an amazing place. It's the home of Ferrari, really. And it's a great circuit. You've got the old banking there, which you can still walk on. And the food is obviously amazing. It's just very, very Italian. Police in Armani suits, people riding around on scooters, stunning. So I think I've done three there. I've done Spa, Monza, and Monaco. So take your pick.
Start calling you Switzerland, I think, because you like to stay kind of neutral and not pick a favourite when it comes to drivers, teams, or race destinations.
Monaco, there you go, Monaco.
Monaco's a great choice, and Monza I haven't been to, but that is part of next year's plan.
You will love it. It's an amazing, the history, if you can walk around it or cycle around the track, it's stunning. To come down to the end of the start straight, into the chicane bit there, so S's, and to walk through all of that. It's a stunning place, definitely. I look forward to seeing your trip there, because it's amazing, yeah.
On to the second question now. So if you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would you choose to go on a holiday with and why?
I thought long and hard about this, and I've come up with Graham Hill.
Right.
Damon Hill's dad. So obviously I never met Graham. I've heard many great stories about him. I've seen him talk things that he said. He was very, very witty, very clever guy, a bit of a playboy. He was hanging around with Stirling Moss. And it's probably that golden era where Formula One was very, very dangerous. It would have been very different to the Formula One that I have known and that we know. But share some DNA from that time. And I think that he would be a very interesting person to go on holiday with. So yeah, but tough choice, because there's so many others. I mean, James Hunt would be a natural other person, but I don't know whether I could keep up with him. Graham Hill.
Great answer. No one has said Graham Hill before, so that's a first. Great answer.
I will make an honourable mention of Jackie Stewart as well, who I have met and is an amazing raconteur and has so many stories. So if you wanted to go on holiday and just listen to great stories about Formula One from his era and before and after. Jackie Stewart is another great guy. But anyway, I'm still sticking with Graham Hill, though.
Mr. Switzerland coming out again. Yeah, Jackie Stewart would be, it would be great to just sit at a dining room table and just listen to him hold court with a glass of wine and scotch or whatever he drinks. It had to be an amazing experience. And if you could cook any dish from a cuisine from a Formula One race, what would you choose to cook and why?
Should we take back to Monza and pasta? I'd probably do something pasta, something classic Italian dish. All the motorhomes serve pasta, whether they're McLaren or Aston Martin or Ferrari, they all do it. So, and they all do it very, very well. So there's always pasta, but pasta at Ferrari is, you have to experience it.
I can imagine, like, being Italian background myself, they would not be messing with the classic Italian dish, and any pasta that's served from the Ferrari team, I can imagine, would be absolutely exquisite. And
again, a game-changing thing Red Bull did was they would bring in a chef for each Grand Prix weekend, and they were usually Michelin starred or something, and they would do the food for the team and for visitors throughout Grand Prix weekends. So that was a big change that Red Bull brought to food in the paddock, was by bringing different...
Like a named chef.
Your named chef, yeah. Every weekend, different one they would have.
So I see Gordon Ramsay's involved in Formula One now. Like,
I think so, yeah.
In a culinary sense.
Yes.
I'm not sure exactly what his job title is, but
right. I think they do have like a Ramsay kitchen, yeah. Mm,
fabulous. Well, Chris Holding, what a great chat. So many good memories and good stories, and I've loved every second hearing about it. Thank you very much for being a guest on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, fab. And if you've enjoyed what you've listened to, please rate and review, like and subscribe to this podcast. Every interaction with us really helps boost our stats. You can find us on all the social media platforms, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And you can email us too, and away we go, f1podcast@gmail.com. Well, thank you very much, Chris. And thank you, everybody, for having us in your ears. Until next week, and until lights out.
It's lights out and away we go.
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto.
Let's do it.